and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Thursday, October 31st, 2024. A South Sudanese activist says the U.S. election is generating more interest in South Sudan.
You know, elections come with a lot of fever. There's a lot of election fever out there. The U.S. election is kind of touching everybody across the globe. I think to us as South Sudanese, we could not hold ourselves from watching it with admiration.
And Sudan's conflict is producing more refugees who are migrating to East Africa.
Because we have very few resources, we created a WhatsApp group and a Facebook page. We also have TikTok and started trying to spread awareness of what we were doing. Then we started receiving donations from the Sudanese diaspora abroad.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some international relations analysts say the outcome of next week's U.S. elections in the United States will have profound influence on Washington's relations with Africa, especially in trade, security, and climate change initiatives. Darren Teller reports from Johannesburg.
Several Africa watchers are concerned that another Donald Trump presidency will impact negatively on the continent. The Republican candidate is likely to scale down America's presence in Africa, they say, exactly at a time, they say, when Washington should do the opposite. But Peter Palm, distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council Policy Research Organization and a veteran U.S. diplomat in Africa, doesn't see that happening.
Although there's stark contrast between former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris, though they're very, very different people, very, very different policies, traditionally, Africa policy has had great continuity between administrations, both Democratic and Republican.
He was speaking in a recent webinar organized by the Policy Center for the New South. Some skeptics do, however, expect Trump to scrap the U.S.'s preferential trade agreement with Africa, should he win the White House. Under the African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, 35 African countries export thousands of products tax-free to the U.S., earning them billions of dollars. Trump has said America shouldn't be rewarding countries that have close ties with Washington's opponents, most notably China. Yaki Salier, head of South Africa's Institute for Security Studies, is concerned that a second Trump administration will try to force Africa to end partnerships with China, Russia, and others the U.S. is opposed to.
The problem for Africa is that Africa is often forced to make a choice. We can't make that choice. Africa needs China. It's the largest foreign investor, the largest builder of infrastructure in Africa. We need the European Union. Our exports to Europe are much higher value than they are to China. And we need the deep pockets of capital in the U.S. to develop and reduce poverty. We can't choose the one above the other, even as our developmental future will increasingly be determined by a rising Asia.
He tells VOA he thinks Harris is more likely to see value in strengthening relations with Africa and not condemning African countries for their foreign policy choices. On security in Africa, says Pam, Harris and Trump appear to have very different approaches.
I served in the Trump administration as the special envoy for the Sahel. And at the time, we had the first coup in Mali. Despite the fact that we were very quick to condemn the coup, we continued to engage constructively with those that took power. We maintained a pragmatic approach. The Biden-Harris administration has been perhaps a little more doctrinaire. The result has been not only a rupture in a lot of ties with Mali, but the expulsion of U.S. military personnel and bases from Niger. So I'm not sure about the efficacy of that policy. A Trump presidency may be more pragmatic in its dealing with security.
African futures analyst Kofi Kwaku says whether Trump or Harris is in the White House, Africa must get its own house in order.
Africa's world in terms of possibility will only be realized on the quality of the leadership that runs it. And at the heart of this liberation is the sense that those who are going to run these African countries must have a sense of sovereignty, thinking about Africa, not just Africa first, but thinking that Africa must really rely on itself and avoid the dependency that crippled it for so many centuries. And so our hopes and fears must rely on this quality of leadership.
Policies by Harris or Trump can help to develop Africa, he says, but ultimately the continent's future lies in its hands, not Washington's. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Still on U.S. election issues, with about 5 days left for American voters to head to the polls, Kwame Ofori speaks to some South Sudanese at home and in the diaspora on how they feel about the U.S. elections and how it impacts them. The fourth guest in this series is Lona Merikaje, a South Sudanese activist based in the capital, Juba.
I think the fact that we're having a female candidate contesting this election, to me, it's a very important aspect of the whole election process. And I so much look forward to see how the Americans are going to vote. And for me, it's a test of where do women stand in society, and especially in U.S., where we see as beacon of democracy. For me, really, that's a very important aspect of it.
And do you feel like the imagery of a woman, like you said, standing as a presidential aspirant would impact women back home in South Sudan as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of women, especially younger women and young girls for this matter, are so much looking forward, are so much following the process, and it's quite inspirational for them. So in as much as this is a U.S. election, it has an impact. The ripple effect is being felt in the other parts of the world, and South Sudanese women and young girls are not an exception.
If you could speak to either of the candidates, that's Trump and Kamala Harris, what question would you ask them and why pertaining to South Sudan?
Well, I think we are aware about where the two candidates stand and the parties they represent. But I think for me, one of the most important things is where are they going to position the South Sudan case, the South Sudan file. And I would appeal that either whoever goes through should look at the South Sudan file, not like one of the African countries, but rather a file that has a human rights connotation. And whether Trump goes through or Harris goes through, it's a matter of human rights. So the South Sudan issue should be seen in terms of the faces behind the fight.
We both know South Sudan wasn't able to conduct its planned elections for 2024. How does the U.S. elections make you feel, considering you couldn't experience your own elections in South Sudan and also people back home, you know, in South Sudan couldn't experience it this year?
Well, the fact that our elections was postponed against our wish, and people back home really look forward to elections, and the U.S. election is happening around this time, and you know, elections come with a lot of fever. There's a lot of election fever out there. The U.S. election is kind of touching everybody across the globe. I think to us as South Sudanese, we could not hold ourselves from watching it with admiration. And if I'm to put that admiration in words, it's that the Americans are lucky. They get this opportunity all the time to choose. And if they think twice about their choice, they still have another opportunity to choose in the next round. And the fact that American elections, and this is something that has become like a tradition for them, it's normal that elections happen within the election cycle. For South Sudanese, it's luxury. It's something that we are aspiring for. It's a dream. And we hope one day that dream will come to pass in South Sudan as well. So, yeah, many South Sudanese, actually all of us, watch that with aspiration, except those who intentionally do not want to have elections happen in South Sudan.
Come January, whoever wins, is there any particular policy or situation in South Sudan that you would want them to take a critical look at?
Well, I think very important, The engagement on South Sudan need to be, we need to change the gears. And I've seen a number of statements. I think whoever comes to office should maintain that tone, because sometimes it's one way to help people in a very soft way, but sometimes truth is bitter, and that tone needs to be maintained so that we get to see the seriousness and the importance of having elections happen. And as I said, most importantly, the South Sudan file, and even South Sudan file at UN level, I know that US is the pen holder, and we still feel that the South Sudan file should have an attention, but attention for purposes of humanity. It's a human rights issue.
That's Lona Merekaje, a South Sudanese activist, who spoke to my colleague Kwame Ofori this past hour from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Still on U.S. elections, here is a South Sudanese listener who recorded himself commenting on issues to do with the U.S. elections. Let's take a listen.
I'm James Roy Majog from Unity State, Bantu Town, South Sudan. I just want to have a short comment about the USA election, whereby everyone is in good understanding for the U.S. government. It is a democracy government whereby the global world's countries are learning through U.S. ruling how to be democratic. Despite that, there's a lot of challenges whereby Donald Trump was being shot by an unknown certain group of people who want to create a panic during this USA's election. I'm sure the U.S. security personnel may have to sort this and protect everyone to be in a peace and harmony, how this election will be conducted, free and fair election for everyone.
That's a listener from South Sudan who recorded himself commenting on issues to do with the U.S. elections. If you would like to comment on the U.S. elections, our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. Successful Slovenian model turned U.S. First Lady Melania Trump has had a bittersweet experience in the limelight since her husband Donald Trump was elected president in 2016, with the possibility of Melania Trump returning to the White House next year. There is a look at her life and some voter experience for her potential second term. VOA's Veronica Baldras Iglesias has the story.
Her parents named her Melania Knapps. The world now knows her as former U.S. First Lady Melania Trump. She was born on April 26, 1970 in Novo Mesto, Slovenia, formerly Yugoslavia. During her upbringing in the town of Sevnica, her father sold cars and her mother worked in the textile industry. Knapps, however, was interested in fashion, recalls her former school friend Mirjana Jelancic.
She also liked designing. She would make new clothes out of old ones.
Knevs paused her college studies in design and under the name Melania Knaus pursued a modeling career in Europe. In the 1990s, her success brought her to the United States. Ohio University history professor Catherine Jellison via Skype.
As a fashion model, and someone who was often invited to upscale parties in New York, my understanding is that is how she met Donald Trump.
Knaus became Melania Trump on January 22, 2005, and gave birth to her first and only son, Baron, a year later. That same year, she also became a U.S. citizen. Melania Trump's life took a different turn when her husband ran for U.S. president in 2016 with the Republican Party, and she joined him on the campaign trail.
It is wonderful to be here today with you and with my husband. I'm very proud of him.
Donald Trump was sworn in as the 45th U.S. president in January of 2017. As First Lady, Melania Trump toured the world and took on projects like the Be Best campaign, focusing on children's well-being, online safety, and opioid abuse. She kept a lower profile than many First Ladies, but still faced intense media scrutiny, Jellison notes.
Criticized in some quarters for her fashion choices, for her decision not to move into the White House right away, for her Be Best campaign not being one of the most successful public service projects by a first lady.
After leaving the White House, Melania Trump practically disappeared from the public eye. She has occasionally re-emerged to support her husband's 2024 bid for re-election and to promote her memoir.
Writing this memoir has been a deeply personal and reflective journey for me.
Wisconsin voter Austin Smith voted for Donald Trump in 2016. He shared his hopes for Melania Trump's possible return to the White House.
I would like her to maybe take up a couple of pet projects. One thing that I'm really passionate about is school lunches.
Democratic voter Jesslyn Corr would like Melania Trump to be a, quote, impactful first lady.
Going out and talking to, you know, urban communities, going out across the country and making yourself known, not just as a figure that's like standing behind the president, but as a woman with some sort of power.
Analyst Jellison, however, thinks as a second-term first lady, Melania Trump would probably continue to, for the most part, shy away from the limelight. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
If Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris makes history in November by being elected America's first female president, her husband, Doug Emhoff, would also break the barriers as the country's first gentleman. It would be the second time the former entertainment lawyer has made history after spending almost 4 years as the nation's first second gentleman. VOA's Dora Mejor reports.
Doug Emhoff has spent almost 4 years being his wife's biggest cheerleader.
I love you so much. I'm so proud of how you're stepping up for all of us.
It's a role the former entertainment lawyer expects to continue playing if Kamala Harris is elected president. And Emhoff makes history by becoming the first male spouse of a sitting president.
I'm going to approach it the same way. Where can I be most useful to her as her husband, support her, love her, as always, but be there for her. But also, how can I help her as president, help the administration, help the American people being the first? And what issues can I really drive?
Emhoff married Harris in 2014 after meeting on a blind date. As his wife's political fortunes rose, Emhoff very publicly embraced the role of supportive spouse.
He's kind of made it clear, like, I'm not above these support roles. And I don't want anybody to think that just because I'm a man, I can't play in these surrogate and support roles.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Emhoff gave up his law firm job and started teaching at Georgetown University when Harris became vice president. He says his wife pushed him to make the role of second gentleman his own.
Being the first guy doing this, let's talk about gender issues. So I talked a lot about gender equity, pay equity, family leave, child care.
In the United States, political spouses at the highest level have always been women. But Emhoff has shown that he is adaptable, says Anita McBride of American University.
Talks about their family life, says up front, I'm here to my important, most important job is here to support the vice president.
As second gentleman, Emhoff, who is Jewish, has also led an anti-Semitism initiative for the Biden administration. First ladies traditionally focus on social activities, like overseeing state dinners and approving the White House holiday decorations.
You're looking at the food and the flowers and the china. Will that be something that he wants to do? Maybe yes, maybe not.
As president of the Senate Spouses Organization, Emhoff has already shown a willingness to embrace tradition.
There's some lunches, there's an event at the vice president's residence, so I just made sure that I participated in those traditional events. And as first gentleman, there's certain traditions that I fully expect that I will faithfully uphold.
First ladies generally donate their inaugural fashions to the Smithsonian Museum in Washington. Whether a gentleman's suit will soon join the collection remains to be seen. Dora McQuarr, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, Muslim Americans divide their votes. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A survey by the Council of American Islamic Relations showed that Muslim voters favor Jill Stein of the Green Party in the swing states of Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin, while Vice President Kamala Harris leads among Muslim voters in Georgia and Pennsylvania, and Donald Trump leads in Nevada. Khalid Turani, executive director of the Muslim Islamic Relations, American Islamic Relations, rather, explains to viewers, senior analyst Muhammad Al-Ashanawi, the reasons behind these findings.
These findings indicate the total dissatisfaction of the Biden-Harris administration, especially if we compare that number to the voting in 2020 when it was Biden-Trump, when 80% actually of the Arab and Muslim Americans voted in the state of Michigan for Biden. So when you drop from 80% to 29%, that means something went wrong. And the something that went wrong was that total isolation between the Democratic Party and its base, especially among Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, and the progressives. That's one thing. The other is that their desire, the Democratic Party and the Biden Harris administration, to continue to support the Israeli genocide against the Palestinians, Trump, no pun intended, prompts their desire to win the elections. We told them over and over again on many, many occasions, you have to call for a ceasefire. You have to call for a permanent and immediate ceasefire. And they are thumbing their nose at our community. And our community, just like we punished Hillary Clinton when she lost the state by 10,000 votes, and when we rewarded Biden by giving him 80% of our votes, when over 100,000 Arab Americans, Muslim Americans voted for Biden, now we're going to punish them again.
Michigan is a critical swing state. Recently, a Muslim imam endorsed Trump, while another prominent imam called the community to vote for Harris. Does that mean Michigan Muslim voters would reconsider a protest vote trend or abandon the uncommitted approach?
I don't believe we are abandoning the uncommitted approach. I think the abandoned Biden that have become abandoned Harris that later on transformed during the primary elections to voting uncommitted is going to continue to be the trend until November 5th. And I believe many in the Arab American community are going to vote their conscience and they will not vote for either party. So with that said, I believe the endorsements that whether Trump or Harris garnered from some imams, I think these are outliers. If you notice, there's no council of imams that have endorsed, no groups of imams have endorsed. It is just one imam in Hamtramck and one other imam somewhere else in the state who endorsed this candidate or the other. But overall, the community, like the survey showed, the community is going to vote overwhelmingly in comparison to 2020 is going to vote for a third party candidate, whether Jill Stein or Cornel West.
You indicated that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is the top priority issue for the Muslim Americans. What other issues that Muslim American voters would base their voting on?
That is as a priority. Other priorities, I think the economy and health care are some of the issues that are a concern to the Arab American and Muslim American communities. And with that, you can find some diversity. So, I mean, you find that some Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, you know, lean to this party or to that party. Their concerns about Muslim values and family values and how the policies, are they consistent with people's sensibility and their paradigm in terms of what is important to them in terms of their faith and their communities and societies.
That's Khalid Turani, executive director of the nonprofit American Islamic Relations in Ohio. He spoke to VOA's senior analyst Muhammad Al-Ashanawi. In Sudan's Omdurman, the most populous city, Community-funded soup kitchen are feeding those in need with little help from the international community. As one of Sudan's, as one part of Sudan faces famine, the world's first in 7 years, the U.S. and others have called on the warring sides to allow unfettered access to aid groups. Henry Wilkins reports.
When the fighting started in Omdurman, Sudan's most populous city, Ahed Mohamed Ali refused to flee. He said he would rather die in his home than suffer the pain of long-term displacement. Along with other members of the community, they pooled their resources and began cooking and sharing meals for those who remained in the city.
Because we have very few resources, we created a WhatsApp group and a Facebook page. We also have TikTok and started trying to spread awareness of what we were doing. Then we started receiving donations from the Sudanese diaspora abroad.
With the city's economy in a state of collapse since Sudan's war started in April 2023, Ali says his makeshift soup kitchen now feeds 200 families every day, thanks to private donations. Others like it have sprung up across the city with almost no support from international aid groups. An October statement by 11 of the world's biggest humanitarian donors, including USAID, says both sides in the conflict are obstructing aid groups' access to cities like Omdurman. It says systemic obstruction of local and international humanitarian efforts is at the root of this famine. One part of Sudan is undergoing the world's first famine in 7 years, while large swathes of the country are one step away from falling into famine. In an interview with VOA, Sudan's finance minister said aid groups are being given all the access they need.
Yes, of course they have the access. You can talk to them. And actually and no one have obstructed their movements around.
VOA spoke to Refugees International, an advocacy group for displaced people that partners with various international aid groups. Daniel Sullivan is director for Africa, Asia and the Middle East at the organization.
To claim that international NGOs and UN agencies have all the access they need is blatantly false. I've spoken to many partner groups that are working on the ground, and whether it's the direct blatant blocking of aid or the slow rolling of visas and other bureaucratic impediments, clearly people who are working on the ground do not feel that they have the access they need. And
the opposing side in Sudan's conflict, the Rapid Support Forces, did not respond to a request for comment. UN experts have said that due to the lack of access for traditional aid groups, soup kitchens like Ali's are leading the way for the delivery of food aid in Sudan. But Ali says aid groups need to help.
I ask God Almighty to help us reach international aid groups. Reaching these organizations is very important.
He says he's only able to serve one meal a day for those who arrive on his doorstep. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Omdurman, Sudan. All right.
That's all we prepared for you this Thursday, October 31st, 2024. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Bill Bass, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America, when we leave you with Dynamic and the song, Jere Jere.
Sana na min loko ya, loko ya, loko ya ya.